This is Lesson 5, which covers Judges chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. Remember that the theme of the book of Judges is that there was no king in Israel in those days, so every man did what was right in his own eyes. So far, we have seen 5 cycles of sin and redemption. These cycles occurred because Israel did not drive out the remaining enemies out of the land, and the enemies became a snare, and they entrapped Israel by enticing them to follow their pagan gods, which, of course, weren't really gods at all. From Judges chapter 3 through chapter 8, there were 5 enemies raised up by the Lord to punish his people Israel, and then he raised up 5 judges to deliver his people. Othniel was the first one. He delivered Israel from Mesopotamia. Ehud was next. He delivered Israel from Moab. Then Shamgar delivered Israel from the Philistines. The fourth one was Deborah, and she delivered Israel from the Canaanites with the help of Barak. And the fifth one was Gideon, also called Jerubbaal, who delivered Israel from the Midianites. Last week, when we were finishing up chapter 8, we learned a little bit about Gideon's family. Gideon's family tree was more like a forest. He had many wives, with whom he had 70 sons, and he had at least one concubine, with whom he had another son named Abimelech. We also learned that Jotham was the youngest of the 70 sons that Gideon had with his wives. Chapter 9 is the story of Abimelech, but Abimelech was not described as either a judge or as a deliverer. His story is really just an extension of the story of Gideon because it illustrates or demonstrates the legacy of Gideon's downfall at the end of his life. The negative assessment of Gideon's legacy in chapter 8, verses 33 to 35, did not end at his death, but it continued in his son's story. Gideon's story is a pivotal turning point, but it is a turn for the worse as his son's story begins to unfold. Abimelech simply followed the wrong direction that Gideon himself had taken. This wrong direction was clearly manifested in Gideon's misuse of power. This wrong direction was clearly manifested in Gideon's misuse of his power. The power that God gave him became corrupted. Remember that at the beginning of Gideon's story, he was a cowardly and fearful young man with no faith either in himself or in God. It took an inordinate number of signs and confirmations from God to motivate this young man. But once he did catch on, nothing could stop him from applying his power, even when, and perhaps especially when, it was inappropriate. Here are some examples. Remember in this battle where they had no weapons, they just used the trumpets and the torches and the shattered pitchers? Why did the men have to shout for the Lord and for Gideon? This was the Lord's battle, and the men had to have known that because they didn't have any weapons. They had only the torches and the trumpets and the shattered pitchers. Here's another example. When the men of Succoth and Penuel refused to give bread to his troops, Gideon brashly said that when he returned, he would tear their flesh with desert thorns, and then he would tear down their tower. And we know that in the case of Penuel, he did more than just tear down their tower. He killed all the men. And these men were his fellow Israelites. But he had gotten to the point that he was going to brook no opposition to his plans. Here's another example. In Judges 8, verses 20 and 21, Gideon ordered his oldest son to kill the 2 kings of Midian. And then when the boy was unable to, Gideon was not able to see his former self in his son because he had changed so much. So the shy and timid boy that Gideon had once been had become a bully. While he had the right and the obligation under Jewish law to avenge the murder of his brothers, there is no excuse for his treatment of his fellow Israelites in Succoth and Penuel. He just had gotten to the point that he would tolerate no opposition to what he planned. Having been empowered by God to accomplish God's task, Gideon, once he got the taste of power in his mouth, turned on God and became self-assertive. He refused to show to others the patience that God had shown to him. While Gideon did say that only God should rule over the people, his behavior indicated that he felt entitled to rule over the people. His golden ephod became the power of his symbol and his self-glorification. It was a worldly symbol of his rule. But Gideon's leadership not only corrupted the power that God gave him, unfortunately, it also resulted in the idolatry of the Israelites. This corruption of Gideon is all the more difficult to understand when we see that he was given more from God than any other judge. He was not just raised up by God, as we've heard the other judges were. In his case, God came down and sat with him. He is the first judge to whom God granted his spirit. All that Gideon did for Israel was done by the power of God. But then Gideon turned on God and became his own God. And so as a result, it should not surprise us too much when Gideon named his son Abimelech. Remember, Abimelech is the son of Gideon with the concubine. We learned last week that the name Abimelech means "my father is the king." Growing up with this name, Abimelech naturally assumed that after his father's death, the authority to rule would either be his prerogative or that of his 70 half-brothers. The first thing we learn from chapter 9 is that Abimelech is only half Israelite because his father was Gideon, but he was also half Canaanite because his mother was a Shechemite. This provides the background for the confrontation between the sons of Gideon's wives and Abimelech, the son of the Canaanite concubine. Like his father Gideon, Abimelech would tolerate no competition. He determined he would be the king after Gideon, and not only that, but he was going to take the title as well. Gideon had said, "No, I'm not going to rule over you." But Abimelech said, "Not only am I going to rule over you, I'm going to take the title and the crown as well." This was a unilateral decision on his part. He claimed the position for himself without any orders from God, and furthermore, without any need, because there was no military threat at that time. The power that had begun to corrupt Gideon, when that power became self-serving, became even more corrupted in his son Abimelech. Abimelech never acknowledged God, never mind being faithful to him. He simply left the Lord out of his life entirely. Abimelech carved out his own kingdom by creating a major conflict between the families on his mother's side against the families on his father's side. He went to his mother's side and he appealed to their self-interest. Wouldn't they rather have one member of their own flesh and blood, remember he's half Canaanite because of his mother, to rule over them rather than to have 70 men, all of whom were entirely Israelite? The men of Shechem were persuaded by this argument, and they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired, quote, "worthless and reckless fellows" to follow him. Now, this translation of the Hebrew into the English, "worthless and reckless fellows," is far too kind. These were violent and amoral as well as immoral men. A more accurate translation in today's English would be thugs. Baal-berith. Baal means Lord. What does berith mean, those of you who took the class on covenant? It means covenant. So Baal-berith means Lord of the Covenant. What an ironic and tragic name. The Israelites had taken the covenant that God made with them, and they had replaced God with Baal in their covenantal relationship. This shows us the syncretism of religious beliefs among the mixed population of Israelites and Canaanites in Shechem. And what's worse is that these pagan people who became a snare and a trap to the Israelites, they were the people with whom the Israelites were commanded not to enter into covenant. God had expressly prohibited through Moses at least twice and through Joshua as well. Here is a picture I found of the ruins of Baal Berith in Shechem. And then, with his hired gang of thugs, Abimelech rounded up 69 of his 70 half-brothers and then killed them one after another on the same single stone. In those times, a slaughter stone was often used to offer up animal sacrifices. So Abimelech was carrying out a perverted sort of sacrifice on this slaughter stone, which was reserved for animals, and he was doing it in contempt of God's command, which forbade human sacrifice. Jotham, the one half-brother who escaped the slaughter, went to Mount Gerizim and presented a parable to the men of Shechem. In the parable, the trees decide that they want to have a king rule over them. First, they ask the olive tree, but the olive tree declines because it was too involved in fulfilling what olive trees do best, which is to produce oil for the use of man and for the worship of God. The tree understands that its place in God's economy is to bear fruit in accordance with its nature. If it accepts the invitation to become king, then it will cease to perform the very function by which God is honored and man is served. The fig tree and the vine have the same response. They are perfectly content to fulfill the purpose that God has ordained for them. In desperation, then, the trees turn to the thorn bush. Unlike the other three trees, which contributed positive values to human life and to divine worship, the thorn bush has nothing to contribute to either. So he gladly accepts the offer and invites them to take shelter in his shade. Now that's ridiculous. That's physically impossible. How can a thorn bush provide cover to trees that are much taller and fuller? Moreover, to attempt to crawl under a thorn bush would be rather painful as you got pierced by the thorns. Jotham used a conditional phrase twice in that speech. The phrase is, "If you have acted honorably and in good faith." Some translations say, "If you have acted with integrity and in good faith." This phrase is important because it spells out the reason for the corruption of power in Gideon and in his son Abimelech. Power will corrupt leaders if they do not act with faithfulness or integrity towards God and their fellow human beings. In this parable, who's the thorn bush? Clearly, it is Abimelech. A worthless thorn bush cannot be made a king in good faith. So the only possible result for making Abimelech a king is disaster, both for himself and for those who choose him. So the parable is a prophecy of the end of Abimelech and the end of the people of Shechem. The purpose of the parable is to condemn Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem for not acting in good faith and with integrity towards God. Now, note, it is not the leadership itself that is condemned. Rather, what is being criticized here is the lust for power and self-serving interest that corrupts the true nature of leadership. There's nothing inherently wrong with leadership. One can be an effective leader so long as serving God and mankind takes priority over status and power attainment. After Jotham gave this prophetic parable, he fled to Baiir, which is here on the map, and he remained there for probably the whole 3 years which Abimelech ruled over the whole of Israel, not just in Shechem. What happened next in Judges chapter 9 was a fulfillment of Jesus' prophetic statement in the Garden of Gethsemane that those who live by the sword shall die by the sword. Now, I know that chronologically Jesus came after this time. Nevertheless, his statement was as true before his time as it was after his time. Last week, we talked about an element of literature called dramatic irony, and that happens when the reader knows something that the characters in the story do not. This week, the element of literature that is highlighted is poetic justice. In its purest form, poetic justice is when one character plots to undermine another, and then he ends up getting caught in his own trap. all the characters in the account that goes from Judges chapter 9, verse 23, to the end of chapter 9, all the way to verse 57, all these people thought they could play politics to their own advantage, but in the end, it was politics that resulted in their own destruction. The political game had already begun between Abimelech and the Shechemites. Abimelech had convinced the men of Shechem that it would be better to have one ruler rather than 70, and secondly, it would be better for this ruler to be related to them rather than to be ruled by an unrelated group of 70 men. The men of Shechem were easily persuaded by this argument because it appealed to their own self-interest. If the ruler over them was a relative, it's logical to assume that he might have more reason to act favorably towards them. Clearly, they were not interested in getting a good ruler. Their main consideration was a political one, which was how much influence and control would they have over the new leadership. And one ruler is a lot easier to manipulate than 70. And if that ruler has depended on your sponsorship to gain power, he is even easier to manipulate because he owes you. There was another factor to consider. Shechem was a prominent Canaanite city in the territory of Manasseh. Here it is on the map. But Gideon's hometown was Ophrah. Here it is on the map. And while Gideon ruled, Ophrah got more attention. So there's also this fight for regional supremacy going on, and Abimelech plays well to that advantage. But in verse 23 of Judges chapter 9, God intervenes to begin the downfall of Abimelech. The NASB translation says, "Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem." Now, this does not mean that God sent a demon upon someone. The New King James Version says, "God sent a spirit of ill will." Some of the paraphrases say, "God stirred up trouble between Abimelech and the men of Shechem." This is the meaning intended. God is free to use anything and everything at his disposal to accomplish his will. In this instance, he dealt with Abimelech in a rather unconventional way. He used evil to overcome evil. And while God's ways are much higher than our ways and therefore beyond our understanding, we can take comfort in the knowledge that it is God who has a hand in the downfall of Abimelech. It reassures us that God is actively participating in the affairs of the world. So God sent this spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem turned on Abimelech. They began to ambush and to rob travelers along the roads. Well, an increased crime rate is one sure way to spoil the popularity of any leader. Then we've got another man who comes along. Geal is his name, and he easily persuaded the Shechemites to follow him instead of Abimelech. And ironically, he used the very same argument that Abimelech had used to sway the Shechemites to support him in the first place. Abimelech had rallied the people to support him instead of Jotham and all of his brothers, because they, all the brothers, the 70 brothers, were 100% Israelite, and Abimelech was only 50% Israelite and 50% Canaanite / Shechemite. Geal pointed out to them that he was a man who was a full-blood Canaanite, not just a half-blood like Abimelech. Why should they be ruled by a half-blood son of Gideon Jerubbaal, when they could be ruled by a full-blood Shechemite, Geal, son of Ebed? If 50% lineage is better than 0%, then shouldn't 100% be better than 50%? And the Shechemites, caring only about their own self-interest, bought the argument and easily turned on Abimelech. But in his power play, Geal forgot to factor in the fact that Abimelech had appointed the governor of the city, a man named Zebul. Now Zebul owed his position to Abimelech, and if Gaal gained the upper hand, he, Zebul, would lose his position. So he, Zebul, sent word to Abimelech of the intended coup. He told Abimelech that he should gather his men and wait in the fields outside the city at night. Then, in the mornings when the people came out through the city walls to go to work in the fields, Abimelech and his men could ambush the people of Shechem. So Abimelech divided his men into four companies and lay in wait. But Gaal happened to go and stand in the entrance of the city gate, and when he did, Abimelech and his men arose from their position. I don't know if this was intentional or if they thought that these were all the people beginning to come out of the city. Gaal saw them, and he ran back and said to Zebul, "There are people coming down from the tops of the mountains." Now, of course, Zebul knew that there were people coming down from the tops of the mountains, and furthermore, he knew who they were. But he replied that Gaal must be seeing the shadow of the mountain as if it were men. But when it became apparent that the shadows were indeed men, Zebul taunted Gaal with his own words against Abimelech. So Gaal and the men of Shechem fought with Abimelech and his men, but Abimelech prevailed. Chapter 9, verse 41 says that Abimelech then remained at Arumah, but Zebul drove Gaal and his relatives out of Shechem. The next day, Abimelech and his men divided into three companies this time, and again they lay in wait in the fields outside the city. When the people came out from the city, he and his men killed the people of Shechem. Then he captured the city and killed all the inhabitants they could find in it, after which they razed the city and sowed it with salt so that the ground would be unfit for anything in the future. Here is a picture I found of the ruins of Shechem. This is supposed to be a picture of the east gate of the city where Zebul and Gaal watched Abimelech's forces advance on the city as the dawn was breaking. You can see that there are four prominent corners here. That's how wide the city wall was. And you would go through and underneath an entrance through the wall where the city gates were to enter into the city or to go out of it. But when Abimelech and his men came into the city, they discovered that the leaders of Shechem and many other people had taken refuge in the inner chamber of the temple of El Berith. Now remember, El is an earlier name for Baal. It does not refer to the one true and living God. It's not clear to me whether this temple of El Berith is the same building as the Tower of Shechem. That just isn't clear to me from the text. But when Abimelech learned of the presence of these people, he and his men cut down branches of trees, set it all around the Tower of Shechem, and set the whole thing on fire so that about 1,000 men and women perished. This was a terrible fulfillment of the prophecy of Jotham's parable, chapter 9, verse 20, which said that fire would come out from Abimelech and would consume the citizens of Shechem. Chapter 9, verse 50 tells us that Abimelech after that went to Thebez and captured the city, that is, all but a strong tower in the center of the city, into which the remaining inhabitants of the city had fled for refuge. Abimelech intended to use the same tactics against it that he had used against the Tower of Shechem, but as he approached the entrance of the tower to start the fire, a certain woman threw a millstone on his head from the upper wall, crushing his skull. Because Abimelech did not want it said of him that he had been killed by a woman, he asked his armor bearer to draw his sword and finish him off, which the young man did. The last three verses of Judges chapter 9 are a satisfying ending to the story of Abimelech. The curse of Jotham happened to Abimelech and to the men of Shechem for what they had done to Jotham's brothers. And despite being finished off by his armor bearer, Abimelech joined the ranks of Sisera. Remember him? He also died at the hands of a woman. Jael's the one who put the tent peg through his head. Abimelech asked his armor-bearer to finish him off because he feared that his death at the hand of a woman would be remembered. And guess what? That is precisely what is recorded in history. Again, there was poetic justice. Abimelech had murdered Gideon's 70 sons, less one, on a single stone, and yet he died from a single stone himself, which was the millstone dropped on him by a woman. Moreover, it was the curse of the only one of Gideon's 70 sons whom Abimelech was not able to kill. That is, it was Jotham's curse which came true for Abimelech and for the people of Shechem. There still was no king in Israel, and still every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now, remembering that Abimelech was not a judge or a deliverer of Israel, but merely a continuation of the legacy of Gideon, the next judge appears in chapter 10. There are only two verses devoted to this judge. His name is Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo. And he is of the tribe of Issachar, but he lived in the hill country of Ephraim. He judged Israel for 20 years, then died and was buried. The next judge gets a whole three verses, Judges chapter 10, verses 3 through 5. His name was Jair. He was called a Gileadite, which was probably a reference to the tribe of Gad, and he judged Israel for 22 years. His family must have been one of great wealth because he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities in the land of Gilead. Then Jair died, and he was buried. Chapter 10, verse 6 states that then the cycle began again. This seems to indicate that the cycle of sin began after Jair died. Now the Israelites were not content to forsake the Lord and serve the gods of Canaan. Now they also followed the gods of those outside the land of Canaan, including the gods of Aram, Sidon, Moab, Ammon, and the Philistines. The foreign gods had simply permeated every aspect of the lives of the Israelites. Again, we are told that it was the Lord himself who sold his people into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. These enemies didn't just conquer Israel without the Lord God's knowledge. He brought it about because of his anger toward their sin. He is sovereign, and he still rules over the nations and the peoples of the world, even when, from our viewpoint, it doesn't seem so. Judges chapter 10, verses 10 through 16 are different from any others in the whole book of Judges. When the people cried out to the Lord, admitting that they had forsaken him and served foreign gods, this time the Lord reminded Israel of the enemies from whom he had delivered them in years past. Moreover, he told them this time to seek deliverance from the other gods that they had chosen. He pointed out the cycle in which Israel had lived for, by that time, about 300 years. The response of the Israelites was also not typical. Instead of continuing to beg for deliverance, they surrendered to his justice. Perhaps they were resigned to a much-deserved punishment, so long as the Lord would still deliver them. Verse 16 says, "They put away the foreign gods from among themselves, and they began to serve the Lord." Then the last part of verse 16 says, "And he, the Lord, could bear the misery of Israel no longer." This means that, despite the unfaithfulness of the Israelites, God still saved them because he could not bear to see them suffer. God's long-suffering, his mercy, and his compassion are truly great. In this case, he was moved by compassion on a relatively small scale, but it was the same principle that led him to give his son, Jesus Christ, to be a sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. The last two verses of Judges chapter 10 look like a preparation for war. The Ammonites gathered together and they camped in Gilead. Here it is on the map. And the Israelites gathered together and they camped in Mizpah of Gilead. While there, the Israelites began to search among themselves for someone to lead the fight against the Ammonites, and they declared, whoever would lead them in the fight against the Ammonites, he would be the head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Incidentally, the Mizpah in Gilead is not the same as this Mizpah over here on the map. This is the one from Judges chapter 20, verse 1. There are several places associated with Israel which were named Mizpah, which, remember, means a watchtower or a lookout. That's right. With chapter 11, we come to the next judge, who's named Jephthah, and he is the son of Gilead. Notice that in verse 1, he is described as a, quote, valiant warrior, close quote. Now, let's compare this with how the description of Gideon began. There, the angel of the Lord called him a valiant warrior, but it wasn't until much later he actually became that. But the first description given of Jephthah was that he already was a valiant warrior. Jephthah is the son of a harlot. The sons of Gilead and his wife had driven Jephthah out of the house. Jephthah also hangs out with thugs in Tob. Here's Tob on the map. It was a desolate region. Verse 3 euphemistically calls these guys, quote, worthless fellows, close quote. He also became the head of the men of Gilead. It was the elders of Gilead who sought him out and asked him to lead. Let's look at chapter 10. Look at verse 18. Notice that the leaders have said, the man who will lead the fight against the Ammonites, he will become the head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Now flip over to chapter 11, verse 6. When the elders of Gilead approach Jephthah, they don't offer him that position. They offer him a lesser position as a military leader. This is a different Hebrew word from the Hebrew word that is translated as head. Jephthah's response to them was quite sarcastic. He reminded them that, well, you drove me out of my father's house. Now you want me to lead you? At that point, then, they did offer him to be the head as well as the military leader. Only then did he accept their request. So in the end, he was both their head and their military commander, and he also served as a judge of Israel for a period of 6 years. We learn this later from Judges 12, verse 7. But from verse 11 of chapter 11, it appears that they made him their head before they went to battle. Chapter 11, verses 12 through 28 contain Jephthah's response to the king of Ammon. And remember, it was the Ammonites in this case who were the aggressors. In this message he sent to the Ammonite king, Jephthah attempted to persuade him to back off. Clearly, Jephthah knew of the Lord because he began by reciting the history of Israel from the time of Egypt to the present time. When the Israelites were traveling from Egypt to the land of Canaan, to the Promised Land, they had to travel first through Edom and Moab. Despite their friendly request, they were rejected by both the Edomites and the Moabites, and they had to bypass their land because the Lord had told Israel, don't provoke them to war. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 2. Finally, the Israelites had come to the land which was occupied by Sihon, the king of the Amorites. Sihon and his army had not only denied the Israelites' passage, but they also deliberately fought against the Israelites, but they lost, and that's how the land was taken. In short, Israel did not take the land from the Ammonites, but from the Amorites. This event is recorded in Numbers chapter 21, and it occurred just before Israel crossed the Jordan at the beginning of the book of Joshua. Therefore, from the taking of the land and all the time of the judges up to chapter 11, approximately 300 years had elapsed. While the first argument was historical, the second was a theological argument. All the ancient Near Easterners accepted that each nation had a patron deity whose primary duty was to provide them with their land. The God of Israel had given this land to Israel. while the Ammonites should just stick to whatever land their gods had given them. And the third argument that Jephthah made was a personal insult. When the Israelites took this land from the Amorites, the Moabite king Balak did not dare to fight or quarrel with them. Moreover, in the 300 years that Israel had possessed this land that originally had belonged to the Amorites, no one had dared to try to take it from Israel. Since none of the current king's predecessors had ever tried to take this land, did the current Ammonite king think himself better than they? Clearly, the implication was that Jephthah did not think the current Ammonite king could take the land. In short, Jephthah told the Ammonite king that the wrong was not done by Israel, but by the Ammonites in trying to take land which the Lord God of Israel had given long ago to his people. Now, what about Jephthah's arguments? Do you think they have merit? In the historical argument, Jephthah proved that Israel had legitimately occupied the land when they came from Egypt. The land had never belonged to the Ammonites in the first place. In the theological argument, since the God of Israel had successfully chased the Amorites out of the land, the Israelites had the right to take what their God had given them. And in the personal argument, Jephthah successfully insulted the Ammonite king by comparing him unfavorably with kings of the past who had not even tried to occupy the land for 300 years. Chapter 11, verse 28 states that the king of the Ammonites disregarded the message from Jephthah. He paid no attention to it, and clearly he did not respond to it. It seems that he lost his claim in the debate, and he lost face as well. Jephthah's arguments were utterly convincing, utterly convicting, and utterly unanswerable. But now war was inevitable. One interesting thing about Jephthah is that the text does not say that the Lord raised him up, as it does with the earlier judges. Yet we know that this is the case, that Jephthah was a judge, for two reasons. The first is that chapter 12, verse 7 says that Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. That means he was a judge. The second is that chapter 11, verse 29 tells us that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. There are only 4 judges of the 12 we're going to study in this semester who shared this honor. The first was Othniel, the second Gideon, Jephthah's the third, and Samson is the fourth. Unlike Gideon, Jephthah was a man of faith. Many times he acknowledged that it was God who had given the victory. And Jephthah is listed in Hebrews chapter 11 as one of Israel's heroes of the faith. Unfortunately, while he was a man of great faith, he was not a man of wisdom. He made an unnecessarily rash vow that led to the sacrifice of his only child. In addition, the emotional baggage that he carried as a result of the rejection of his half-brothers, combined with his pride, resulted in the deaths of thousands of his countrymen. Let's consider the first impulsive, disastrous mistake that resulted in the death of his only child. This is covered in chapter 11, verses 30 through 40. Verse 29 of chapter 11 states, "Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, then through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he went on to the sons of Ammon." Now it is clear by this time that Jephthah has been appointed by God for his office of judge and deliverer of God's people. Strong in the power of the Lord, Jephthah is moving out, confident of success in his undertaking. But before the battle began, Jephthah made his disastrous and wholly unnecessary vow. He had reason enough to be confident of success, especially when he found the Spirit of the Lord upon him, and yet, when it came right down to the actual battle, he seemed to hesitate. In Old Testament times, making vows to God was common, but vows were always voluntary, never coerced. God gave regulations to his people in the making of vows. These are all set out in Leviticus chapter 27. The point here is that Jephthah had more than one option available if he wanted to make a vow. Because God knew of the fickle nature of mankind, he also made certain provisions for people who wanted to reverse their vows. These are also found in Leviticus chapter 27. There were, however, certain kinds of vows that God specifically stated would be non-redeemable, irrevocable vows. Leviticus 27 verses 28 and 29 say, "Anything which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has, of man or animal or of the fields of his own property, shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. No one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death." The Hebrew word for this kind of vow was cherem, C-H-E-R-E-M. Literally, it means to be shut in by a net. This was something separated from common use and set apart exclusively for God. It could not be redeemed back. It was condemned to destruction. An example of cherem was Israel's sin offerings. Those animals were consecrated to be burned completely. They were burnt offerings as God poured out his righteous wrath upon them. This is why cherem, the word, is sometimes translated as, quote, "the accursed thing," close quote. Whatever was cherem had to be utterly destroyed in the same manner that God deals with sin. We have seen already that God sometimes invoked the law of cherem upon Israel's enemy. During the time of Joshua and the judges, the time we're looking at, God demanded that all the people be driven out and everything belonging to them be totally destroyed. Unfortunately, it was this kind of vow that Jephthah made. God didn't demand it. It was self-initiated and self-inflicted. Judges chapter 11, verse 30. "And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, 'If thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering.'" Well, what was the first thing to come out of the door of Jephthah's house to meet him when he returned from the battle with the Ammonites? It was his one and only child, his daughter. She is unnamed. We don't know what her name was. Commentators are divided into two separate camps over what Jephthah meant when he made this vow, and also into what he actually did when he carried it out. Let's consider first what he might have meant in making this vow. Some commentators say that Jephthah's knowledge of Israel's history, which was clearly on display in his argument with the king of the Ammonites, was also an indication of his knowledge of God's law, in which human sacrifices were viewed as an abomination to God. Thus, these people claim he could not have meant to offer a human sacrifice if that was the first thing to come out of the door of his house to meet him. The fact that the Canaanites offered their sons and daughters to the god Molech in the fire was one of the reasons why God had commanded the Israelites to drive out the Canaanites. The commentators who take this view believe that Jephthah was merely devoting his daughter to the service of the Lord in the sense of becoming like a nun. She would not be allowed to marry and to have children. The other camp of commentators say that the words of the vow prove conclusively that Jephthah intended his vow to apply to human beings and not animals, because the Israelites did not allow animals inside the house. Therefore, only one of his household could be expected to come out of the door of his house to meet him. In those times, it was common for servants of the family and sometimes for women to welcome a homecoming warrior. Perhaps Jephthah thought that sacrificing one of his women servants would be no big deal. Moreover, these commentators do not express surprise that Jephthah may have contemplated a human sacrifice because of his long residence in Tob, which was a pagan city where such rites probably were quite common. Moreover, these commentators find no difficulty with the fact that the Spirit of the Lord had come upon Jephthah. The fact that the Spirit of the Lord empowered him with the ability to vanquish the Ammonites doesn't mean that God also endued him with spiritual wisdom. After all, the Spirit of the Lord had come upon Gideon, but that didn't prevent him from erring in the matter of his golden ephod. Also, in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we have the explicit statement that not all spiritual gifts are given to every person. And we have an example in Galatians chapter 2 of Peter reverting back to Jewish ways and avoiding Gentiles until Paul rebuked him. So it's possible for the Spirit of the Lord to be upon someone and still for that person to make a grave mistake. Obviously, there are several application points for us here. The first is that the end does not justify the means. We need to be careful to remember Jephthah's vow. When we want something so badly, we are willing to give up anything to get it. If we're in that position, we need to seriously rethink whether such a goal is even worthy. And more importantly, if we're pursuing a goal in such a manner, what kind of person are we becoming? No goal is that important that we can give any leeway to Satan. The devil is more than happy to cut a deal with you. We have to remember that God is the one who knows what is best for every situation, and we are much safer to rest and trust and leave all of the ends and the means in his hands. A second application point for us is that we must remember to practice restraint. Reckless and impulsive speech and actions are irresponsible and immature. Moreover, there may be innocent victims who suffer as a result of it. Sometimes the pain and the loss are irreversible, and everyone involved is made to bear the consequences for the rest of their lives. The third application for us is, for goodness sakes, don't make vows at all. Don't swear at all, by heaven or by earth or by anything else. In the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 of Matthew, verses 33 to 37, Jesus instructed us simply to let our yes be yes and our no be no. Well, since we know that God did give the Ammonites into Jephthah's hand, what happened to this unnamed daughter of Jephthah? We've talked about the two possible interpretations of his intent. What did he mean when he made this vow? Now let's talk about the two possible interpretations of the fulfillment of this vow. Did Jephthah kill her, or did he just set her apart as the equivalent of a nun? We know that he kept his vow, and we cannot help but be very impressed by the spiritual maturity of this daughter who did not beg for release, but encouraged her father to keep his vow. But what actually happened, we will never know. The two opposing arguments are set out in today's handout. Those who have argued that she was not killed, but was rather devoted to serve God in tabernacle ministry, where she was committed to celibacy, they emphasize the fact that subsequent verses focus on her virginity rather than her impending death. In chapter 11, verses 37 and 38, the daughter asks for a two-month delay so that she and her companions could go to the mountains and weep for her virginity. On the other hand, those who believe that she was actually killed and her body burned focus on the nature of the vow that Jephthah made and the fact that in the context of the time of the judges, Jephthah was, like every other man, doing what was right in his own eyes, heavily influenced by the surrounding pagan culture. In addition, the yearly commemoration of this amazing daughter is justified only if she was killed and not simply forbidden to marry and have children. This view is reinforced by the fact that it was she and not her father who won the battle in the power of God, who was remembered and commemorated on an annual basis by the community. It's also interesting to note that all the artists who have portrayed this event take the view that Jephthah did kill his daughter and then offered her body as a burnt sacrifice. Here are two artists' renderings. Whatever view you take, remember that this daughter was Jephthah's only child. Whether she died or she was a living sacrifice, Jephthah had no one to carry on his name after his death. In chapter 12, we have another confrontation between the tribe of Ephraim and a judge of Israel. The first time we saw this was in chapter 8, when Gideon won the battle against the Midianites, and then the Ephraimites came and were angered because they hadn't been included in the battle. Gideon was able to appease their anger by diplomatically pointing out, well, you killed the generals of the Midianite army, and therefore the implication was that they had done more than all of Gideon's men had done. Here in chapter 12, the Ephraimites are coming up, this time against Jephthah, again expressing their extreme displeasure that they were not included in the battle against the Ammonites so that they might be allowed to share in the spoils of the victory. As before, pride was the basis of this unreasonable anger. To help us understand, remember that Gideon was of the tribe of Manasseh on the same side of the Jordan as the Ephraimites. Jephthah was also of Manasseh on the other side of the Jordan. Well, what else do we know about the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh? They were both the sons of Joseph, and they were more jealous of each other than of any of the other tribes. Remember also that when Jacob/Israel gave his blessing, he crossed his hands and gave the preference to Ephraim over Manasseh, who was the firstborn. But Ephraim was apparently not content with the honor of that blessing, and they were displeased if the tribe of Manasseh had any honor given to it. So the Ephraimites were angry with Gideon of the tribe of Manasseh, and now they were angry with Jephthah, who was of the tribe of Manasseh, and they demanded to know why he went to fight against the Ammonites without calling them to participate. Frankly, the answer was a really good one. It was the men of Gilead who had called Jephthah to lead them, not the men of Ephraim. But before Jephthah even has a chance to explain, they threatened to burn his house down upon him. Jephthah was now a conqueror over the common enemies of Israel. They were Ephraim's enemies as well. And the Ephraimites should have come to congratulate him and to thank him for the work that he had done that had benefited all the tribes of Israel. Also, they might have offered him their condolences because he was in the midst of mourning the loss of his daughter, in whichever way it was that he actually lost her. Unlike Gideon, Jephthah made no attempt to appease these Ephraimites. In the latter part of verse 2 of chapter 12, Jephthah says, "When I called you." Now, this circumstance is not given to us in the main narrative. It probably occurred when Jephthah was first chosen to be the leader by the Gileadites and when Ephraim would probably have ignored his leadership anyway. But then Jephthah went on to explain that he had engaged in this war in a defensive manner against the Ammonites, all without the help of the Ephraimites, thank you very much. And to his credit, Jephthah gave all the glory to God. He said, "And the Lord gave them into my hand." The implication is, if God saw fit to use Jephthah for God's own glory, why should the Ephraimites be offended about it? In opposing Jephthah, then, they were in effect opposing God. But apparently this response did not appeal to the reason of the men of Ephraim. At the end of verse 4 is the insult which the Ephraimites hurled at the men of Gilead. In essence, they said to them, "You Gileadites that dwell here on the other side of the Jordan, you're fugitives from Ephraim." They're of the tribe of Manasseh, but they're calling them fugitives of Ephraim. "You are the scum and the dregs of the tribes of Joseph," of which Ephraim, by the way, is chief. "And everyone among the tribes of Ephraim and of Manasseh knows that you are." The result was that the men of Gilead fought against the men of Ephraim, and the men of Gilead defeated the men of Ephraim. Then they cut off their retreat. Verse 5 says the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan opposite the territory of Ephraim. If anyone was trying to flee and attempting to cross, they could tell by his accent whether he was an Ephraimite or not, and if he was, they killed him. As a result, 42,000 men of Ephraim were killed. This is the second civil war among the tribes of Israel. The first was of all the tribes of Israel against the tribe of Benjamin, where they almost completely wiped it out. That's recounted in Judges chapters 19 through 21, but it occurred chronologically, remember, at the beginning of the period of the Judges. Let's back up a little bit and look at this accent of the Ephraimites. It is not uncommon for dialects of the same language to occur within a country. We can see that very plainly here within America. And remember that Peter, the Apostle Peter, was recognized as a Galilean because of his accent. Well, it seems that the Ephraimites could not say the SH sound, sh. All they could say was the S sound, S. So the Gileadites tested every person by requiring him to say the word Shibboleth, which means either an ear of corn, or it can also mean river. And in this context, clearly it referred to the river. So the Gileadites probably said to the person, ask permission to cross over the river, the Shibboleth. The Ephraimites could only say Sibboleth. And so the word Shibboleth has come to have the meaning of a peculiarity of pronunciation or behavior or mode of dress that distinguishes a particular class or set of persons. It can also be a means of exclusion as well as inclusion. It can be a custom or a phrase or a use of language that acts as a test of whether you're going to belong to or whether it's a stumbling block to your becoming a member of that particular class or group. The irony here is that the Ephraimites, in their insult of the Gileadites, had called them fugitives, and now they really were fugitives themselves. In verse 7, we are told that Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years and then died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. In Judges chapter 12, verses 8 through 15, we are told about three more judges of Israel. The first was Isban from Bethlehem. Commentators are divided on whether this is the Bethlehem that's in the territory of Judah or the Bethlehem that's in the territory of Zebulun. All we are told about this judge is that he had 60 children, and he lived not only long enough to bring 60 children into the world, but he also lived long enough to see all of them married. Despite this long life, he judged Israel only 7 years. Then he died and was buried. After Isban, the next judge was Elon. He was from the tribe of Zebulun. He judged Israel for 10 years, then died and was buried. After Elon came Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, which just means that he was from the city of Pirathon in the territory of Ephraim. In Elon, the tribe of Ephraim began to recover its reputation, which since the time of Deborah had been quite tarnished by the likes of Abimelech and the tribe in general as it dealt with Gideon and with Jephthah. Like the first one we've just listed, Isban, Abdon was a prolific father. He had 40 sons who in turn produced 30 grandsons. We're not told how many daughters and granddaughters he had as well. Nevertheless, he must have been quite wealthy because all of the sons and all of the grandsons, that's 70 of them, rode on donkeys. We are told that he judged Israel for 8 years and then died and was buried. Did anyone notice the contrast between these two judges, one of whom had 30 sons and 30 daughters and the other of whom had 40 sons and 30 grandsons? Those two on the one hand, and Jephthah on the other hand, who had only one daughter, and she was either killed or was committed to a life of celibacy. It appears that during the administration of Jephthah, who ruled for 6 years, Ibzan, who ruled for 7 years, Elon, who ruled for 10 years, and Abdon, who ruled for 8 years, that's a total of 31 years, it appears that the Israelites had peace during that time. There was plenty of time for procreation of children and grandchildren, and at least two of these judges lived very long lives. Unfortunately, however, during this time of rest, the Israelites apparently corrupted themselves further, because by the beginning of chapter 13, we learn that they were delivered into the power of the Philistines by God. But that's the subject for next week's lesson. For now, let us remember to be in prayer, fervent prayer, that our nation does not continue down the path that Israel trod in the time of the judges. We are truly in a time where, in the absence of godly leadership, every man of America is doing what is right in his own eyes. We have excluded God from our public life as thoroughly as Abimelech excluded God from his life. We need, as individuals and as a nation, to repent and recommit our ways to God in the hope that he will not say to us, as he did to Israel in Judges chapter 10, verses 13 and 14, "I will no longer deliver you. Go and cry out to the gods you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of distress." Our final hymn. O God of earth and altar, bow down and hear our cry. Our earthly rulers falter, our people drift and die. The walls of gold entomb us, the swords of scorn divide. Take not thy thunder from us, but take away our pride. From all that terror teaches, from lies of tongue and pen, from all the easy speeches that comfort cruel men, from sale and profanation of honor and the sword, from sleep and from damnation, deliver us, good Lord. Tie in a living tether the prince and priest and thrall. Bind all our lives together, smite us, and save us all. In ire and exultation aflame with faith and free, lift up a living nation, a single sword to thee. Amen.